From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When the band The Go-Betweens reunited in 2000, it was great news for their fans in America, Europe, and their native Australia. On today's Fresh Air, you'll hear why. We'll feature an interview with the band's founders, Grant McLennan and Robert Forster, and listen to their new CD. The band broke up in 1990 after 11 years together. If you missed them the first time around, our rock critic Ed Ward has a retrospective of their work. Also, we talk with Paul Feig. He created the hilarious but short-lived TV series Freaks and Geeks and wrote a memoir about his dorky high school years titled Kick Me. Now he has a new memoir about his college years and early 20s. It's called Super Stud, or How I Became a 24-Year-Old Virgin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the band The Go-Betweens reunited in 2000, about 10 years after breaking up, it was great news for their devoted fans in America, Europe, and their native Australia. Here's what rock critic Robert Krysgaard wrote about the band in The Village Voice. There's no denying that The Go-Betweens are a bookish taste. If you're bored by the literary, you won't get them. But rather than lyric poets, Robert Forster and Grant McLennan are better conceived as short story writers. This music has no equal in pop, and also no equal of any note in the contemporary short story. In a few minutes, we'll meet Grant McLennan and Robert Forster and listen to music from The Go-Betweens' new CD, Oceans Apart. But first, our rock historian Ed Ward has a profile of the band.
Back in 1978, Grant McLennan and Robert Forster were, I imagine, two bored guys who read too much and lived in Brisbane, Australia, a place neither remembers with much affection. They were art students at the University of Queensland and soon discovered they could write songs together. And so, in the punk rock spirit of the times, they went into a studio and made a record. It sure wasn't the kind of punk the Saints and other Australian punk bands were doing, but it was original, and people down under started paying attention. McLennan and Forster realized that local success wasn't enough, so in 1979, they packed their guitars and flew to London, where they literally didn't know a single person. From there, they headed to Paris, and from there, even more unlikely, they went to Glasgow, where a new label called Postcard invited them to make a single.
I look at you and I wonder why. Extinct and I'm beginning to cry. Give me a bank book, and sometimes I think I need to head. The best detective.
Back home, this made them heroes, and they found themselves in demand. Trouble was, they needed a drummer. And the one they found, a lanky 6-foot-tall woman named Lindy Morrison, was the missing ingredient. Her style was completely unique and seemed to follow the text as much as the rhythm of the melody. Despite wonderful production and catchy hooks, the Go-Betweens never had any hits outside of Australia, which is perhaps understandable given how literary their songs were.
They had problems with their father's law. They sleep in the back of a feminist bookstore. The Clark sisters. The elder sister keeps a midnight vigil. The younger sister, she's not spiritual. The Clark sisters. And they're still gray hair, they're lovely still gray hair, the Clark sisters. Why don't I?
Not only were they literary, they were Australian. The Clark sisters were real friends of Forster's mother, and the portrait he wrote of them could have come from no other country. By the time they recorded the Clark Sisters in 1987, they'd added one more member, Amanda Smith, on violin, oboe, and piano, and her talents opened up the group's sound even more.
Watch the butcher shine his knife, and this town is full of battered wives.
Round, round. She also became Grant McLennan's girlfriend, and whether it was this, the touring, the lack of hits over the years, or possibly none of the above, the band finally called it quits in 1990. Amanda Smith and Lindy Morrison formed a band called Cleopatra Wong, and Forster and McLennan made solo albums. Then, in 2000, they announced a new Go-Betweens lineup. Having heard their new album, Oceans Apart, I'm happy to say that they're as good as ever.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock historian. He lives in Berlin. Robert Forster and Grant McLennan of the Go-Betweens have moved back to Brisbane, Australia. I spoke with them earlier this month when they were performing in the U.S. Before we hear from them, let's listen to the opening track from their new CD, Oceans Apart. This is Here Comes a City. So, Grant McLennan, you were from a cattle ranch in Australia, and Robert Forster, your family, a family of workers, not artists. You were the first college-educated person in your family. How much of a stretch was it for both of you to imagine yourselves in the music world, specifically in the rock world?
This is Grant here. For me, it was a real late kind of development in my life, because as Robert knows, we met each other at university, and we're both doing a kind of a theatre course, an arts degree, and theatre was our major. And at the time, all I wanted to do was write films or, write poetry, go and live in Paris, So music, even though I loved it, wasn't something that I did. And Robert actually asked me to form a band, and I couldn't play an instrument. And it wasn't like I was Jared Malanga from the Velvet Underground and could do a whip dance or something, But Bobby obviously saw something in that crystal ball of his. And I said yes. But like Robert, I had never entertained the thought of having a kind of regular job. It just wasn't something that was on my radar. I was too busy thinking about other things.
Robert Forster, what did you hear in Grant McLennan that made you think you should form a band with him?
I'd been in bands at we hardly played, but I was playing with a friend that I had at university, and we had a schoolboy drummer, and we'd sort of rehearse once a week, once every 2 weeks, and we're doing, like, this is 1975, 76, 77, and we're always trying to find another person in the band, and we couldn't ever find anyone, and my musical tastes were growing away from what the other people in the band wanted to do. You know, like, I was listening to, you know, New York punk and new wave music started to come through and started to really grab my attention, and so I wanted to, I was moving in that direction very strongly, and so I just thought I'd get, you know, like, Grant was you know, like, my best friend, and I just thought, you know, he's on my wavelength, and I can, you know, and also he was musical, you know, he it wasn't like he was somebody who had interest in film and poetry, but had no interest in music. He had a great interest in music, and I just thought I'd ask him. It was outside of him. There was no one else. I don't know what else I would have done, because I didn't know anyone else that I could have or would have asked.
So, Grant McLennan, if you hadn't been in a band before and didn't really play music, what did you think your job in the band was supposed to be?
Oh, I thought it would be to design the posters, shoot the films, probably, well, reasonably useless, actually. But the fact that one of the first songs that Robert showed me some notes to was Lee Remick.
Mm.
And that's kind of, this is a very musical term now, it's in 4-4. He just showed me, you know, I could just plonk down on the E sort of note four times, and then the B note four times, and, you know, sort of thing. So it wasn't that hard initially, but it was like, you know, learning a foreign language. Initially you're kind of excited, but then the work starts, and I think it was, I could see Robert's ambition, and we both were, I think, in some way quite, you know, subconsciously unhappy with our lives then. Brisbane at that time was a very kind of right-wing, very conservative, very un-arty, not very creative kind of town. So to have a friend like Robert and be talking about Patti Smith and, you know, Arthur Rimbaud's poetry and stuff, it was a very special time.
My guests are Robert Forster and Grant McLennan of the band The Go-Betweens. Their new CD is called Oceans Apart. They'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are singers and songwriters Robert Forster and Grant McLennan of the band The Go-Betweens. They have a new CD called Oceans Apart. Let's hear the band's first recording, a single from 1978 called Lee Remick. Lee Remick, The Go-Betweens' first single, and The Go-Betweens have a new CD, which is called Oceans Apart. One of the things I really like about Lee Remick is the ba-ba-ba-ba-ba stuff. I love pop that has things like that in it. Robert Forster, can you talk about why you put that in?
I think ba-ba-bas have been around since Well, Chuck Berry didn't have any, but I think from the early 60s or something. So it's at that time we were, and we still are, but at that time we were very, very pop saturated, just completely in love with the idea of pop in terms of Los Angeles, you know, like 1963 to 1966, you know, just very sort of sun-soaked pop aesthetic was in the band.
And why did you want to write a song about the actress Lee Remick?
Well, at that time, I wanted to write a, you know, I was very sort of conceptual, I guess, in a way, in what I was doing at that time. I was trying to write types of songs. I was trying to write, and I thought, okay, I'm going to write a love song. And I didn't have a girlfriend, and so I thought, okay, you know, got to go to stage two. You know, got to find somebody. And she was someone I always found really attractive, and I found really great. And there just must have been a succession of her films on TV in Brisbane, and I just thought she looked really great, and especially in the 60s, I think that they were the films that I was seeing. And so I wrote about her. I just liked the look of her and the way she was on TV.
So Grant, did you learn to play bass on this song?
I did. I did. And actually, I think anyone out there listening can hear me learning to play bass on it. I don't think I'm going to get a gig in L.A.
So this was, you know, singles were, as far as I know, not making a real big impact on music sales in 1978, and the top 40 was, I think, pretty meaningless by then. So what impact did you expect to have by making a single, and what impact did you have?
Well, the impact, there was another band in our town called The Saints, and they'd made a single called I'm Stranded. And what the concept was, it's like if you're making a single and you're a band right in the middle of, you know, the Midwest and you're in a small town, you if it's good enough, if it's an instant classic, which is what I'm going to call Lee Remick, you hope that it's just going to spring you right out of town. It just means that one day a Learjet's going to land down and you're just going to walk in and you're just going to leave the town that you grew up in behind. That was the concept.
It didn't work, did it?
No, it didn't. It didn't, but it sort of filtered. It sort of had this weird long afterlife. And, it resulted in me meeting Lee Remick in Sydney in the mid-80s. It sort of ended up
you
in a
met
record
her?
Shop. Yeah. And she was out in Australia in 1986 making a film. And someone that worked on the film in the art department knew the band from the late 70s, from 1978. She used to come and see us play. And she was working on the film, and she knew that we were in town. And so, yeah, I went down and met her, which was, you know, extraordinary, you know, to write a song, you know, out of these circumstances that we're talking about now, you know, in 1978. And then eight years later, you meet the movie star that you wrote about.
So when you started recording, how did you see yourselves? Like, how did you want to, like, define yourselves musically and with your image? And where did you see yourself fitting in?
We saw ourselves fitting in as a band that we weren't normal rock and rollers, you know. We weren't two guys that, you know, had every Chuck Berry licked down, had cigarettes dangling out of the side of our mouths, and had, you know, like Rod Stewart haircuts. You know, we'd sort of come from this un-rock and roll background, and we'd sort of been in university, and we had a very, very strong interest in pop culture, you know, in Gilligan's Island, in Mod Squad, you know. At the same time doing literature, you know. It was sort of this weird mixture. And we thought that was interesting in terms of being a rock band or a pop band and having that background, you know. Like, and this was a time in the late 70s when a lot of people that normally weren't in rock bands, I mean, look, you know, someone like the Talking Heads, you know, like they were students, you know, at design school at Rhode Island. You know, it was that sort of concept. It was sort of, instead of, you know, there was 10 million bands in the world, that could play Led Zeppelin, you know, licks. There was, you know, 10 million bands that could do Jimmy Page and Chuck Berry and The Who and all of that. And we just sort of, not consciously, but just because the way we were, we just wanted to do something that was different. So, you know, like we sort of liked bands like the Monkees, you know. we liked, you know, Dylan 64, 66, you know, like we were fixated on that, you know, on Dylan as sort of, you know, amphetamine-driven pop star. You know, that's what we were interested in. And also, you know, television and Talking Heads. And it was like people that normally weren't in rock and roll being in rock and roll and seeing where it would go.
Robert Forster and Grant McLennan of the Go-Betweens. Their new CD is called Oceans Apart. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with the Go-Betweens. Also, life as a young dork. We talk with Paul Feig, creator of the TV series Freaks and Geeks. He's written his second memoir. It's called Superstud, or How I Became a 24-Year-Old Virgin.
What would you do if you turned around and saw me beside you? Not in a dream, but in a song. Would you float like a phantom, or would you sing along? Don't know where I'm going, don't know where it's flowing, but I know it's finding you. What would you do if you saw me driving by in a car? The quickest you ever seen me spin. Would you smile and wave, or would you bow and get in? Don't know where I'm going. Don't know where it's going.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Grant McLennan and Robert Forster, the founders of the band The Go-Betweens. The band was formed in Brisbane, Australia in the late 70s and developed a cult following. They broke up in 1990, but McLennan and Forster reunited 10 years later. They've just released their third CD since reuniting. It's called Oceans Apart. The Go-Betweens have always gotten like really terrific reviews from critics, but the band's had a devoted following, but not an enormous following. Was it ever hard during the years you've been together to stay afloat financially?
Definitely, especially towards the end of the 80s, where we were doing a lot of touring and record companies were sinking money into us, and we were foolish enough to take it. Although there's an argument about that, but and so we sort of trying to keep five people on the road and touring was very, very difficult. In a way, it was a background reason to why we broke up at the end of the 80s. It was like Grant and I having to, you know, another publishing advance, another record company advance. Money, obviously, you have to pay back. And this was a time in the very late 80s where financially it was enormously difficult.
So is that what you mean by it was foolish? It was foolish to take the money from the record companies because then it made you more in hock than
There's two lines on taking money from record companies.
Yes, please.
There's the yes, please one, and which then people, you know, like build studios and people spend the money from the record company knowing they're not going to stay with, well, knowing that the record company's going to drop them, so you try and get as much as you can. And you build things with it. The other line is don't take much money and the record company will then look at the sheet and go, well, you know, they're only $50,000 in debt. We won't drop them. You know, like you play it both ways. And there's endless discussions in band rooms and management, rock management courses about what you should do. You know, you either take the money and run or you don't take so much money and you hope that you stay.
And so what was your strategy?
Well, being the go-betweens was a mess. So it seemed to be now in terms of say like tour support. Like I'll give you a figure. Like we toured with REM like in Europe in 1989, and we're in Australia, and you know, and that cost us something like say 5 weeks on the road with them. That cost us £35,000. Which is, you know, like, I don't know, 50,000, 60,000 American dollars. And that's money that we have to pay off the rest of our lives that went in 5 weeks.
And why do you have to pay that? How come you're not making money? How come you're paying money to open for R.E.M.?
Well, that was a particular thing. I mean, that's you know, you're opening for a big band. The big band gets the money, you know. And that's why most tour support actually goes to bands who get on the bill to play with a big band. Like if we suddenly got a call that said, you know, like U2 want you to do 4 weeks of their tour, like right now, we couldn't afford it. So we'd have to go to a record company and go, okay, you know, and then it's the whole game of is it worth it? It is because we have to stay in hotels. We have to fly to make the shows. And so it gets into that whole, that's often where the money goes is supporting big bands.
Huh. And so the point of doing it in the first place would be to reach the opening act's audience, in this case to reach REM's audience, and hope that they're going to love you and then buy your records, and you'll
exactly,
not only be able to pay back what you owe, you'll start becoming really popular.
Exactly. That's the concept. You will sell a certain amount of records and your profile will be raised that will justify the amount of money that is being spent on doing that exercise. Mm-hmm. And I would say 80% of the time, it fails.
So you must get to really hate the system.
No, not at all. No, I mean we're realists, you know. I mean we know that the music that we do is not music that a lot of people are going to put our posters up on their bedroom walls. You know, it's we're into a different kind of thing, and we always have. The galling thing though is Robert was talking about it before. We really do like pop music.
I was gonna say, let me play a song that I think illustrates how like you're pop, but not just pop, or a little different than pop. And I'm thinking of People Say, which is in the first printing of your new CD. There's an EP that comes with it that includes live performances, and one of them is of the song People Say. Maybe you don't think it belongs in that category.
Oh, no.
No. I think you've nailed it right on the head.
Yeah, People Say is Bob Dylan meets the Monkees.
Something that used to happen all the time, in fact.
Oh, if only he'd met the Monkees. He met the birds, but if he'd met the Monkees. Can't you imagine Bob the Fifth Monkey in the house? 1966, the hair, shades. D. Davey.
Well, why don't we hear people say, and this is from an EP that comes with the first printing of the Go-Betweens' new CD, Oceans Apart.
You got to improve. You walk hardly moves. Your holy sailors with the harbor smells. Feed from your broken shells. So that's how it feels. It's a cruel God that steals the things you love, the things that you hold.
So this is on an EP that comes with the first pressing of your new CD, Oceans Apart. So, you know, the band broke up after 11 years and then reunited in, was it 2000 or 2001?
2000.
How have your ambitions changed in terms of what you want or expect from the band now?
Oh, that's a good question. I think in a way differently when you're in your 20s, even if you're playing like free jazz, you still think it could end up in the top 30. You know, you've still got that idea that you will be in Billboard. It's just something that just goes with you. Just you know, like, and as Grant said before, we are writing pop music. This is sort of it has the whiff and the look of something that's accessible. And so, which has always drawn record companies to us. That's floating around in your mind in your 20s. But overall, I don't think it's ever, I don't think it's changed all that much. It's still, once you're actually, you know, like just, you know, on the focus of writing songs, the focus of recording them well, the focus of touring, that takes up a lot of space in your mind. And so, it's not, other things don't sort of crouch in too much. I think really, we hit on this just a little bit before, I've always thought in terms of success for the band, in terms of like a breakthrough, it was always going to come with a lucky break. It's a song in a film. It's someone covering one of our songs.
Mm-hmm.
It's, we need someone.
Except Michael Bublé.
someone who's just, a big writer, someone will, it'll come that way, as opposed to us spending 2 years on the road and all the commercial rock stations falling over and playing our music. I don't think it's going to happen that way. I never have really thought for a long time. I think it's going to come through a lucky break.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Terry, it's been very, very nice. Thank you very much.
Robert Forster and Grant McLennan of the Go-Betweens. Their new CD is called Oceans Apart. Coming up, a new memoir by the creator of the TV series Freaks and Geeks. We talk with Paul Feig about Superstud, My Life as a 24-Year-Old Virgin. This is Fresh Air. My guest Paul Feig created the short-lived but hilarious TV series Freaks and Geeks, which chronicled the many embarrassments in the lives of several unpopular kids in a Michigan high school. Feig shared many of the embarrassments from his own early geekhood in his memoir Kick Me. Sadly, his awkwardness did not end with adolescence. His new memoir picks up where the first left off. It's called Superstud, or How I Became a 24-Year-Old Virgin. Here's a short reading.
When I'd see a prim and pretty young woman at the drugstore who was pregnant, I would be unable to fathom the idea that she had actually had sex with her husband. I could only imagine that if they did, it was in the most formal of ways, that they had both faced it as something that had to be done in order to carry on the family name, and so it was performed mechanically and impersonally, allowing all involved to retain their dignity and make sure the woman would not be sullied by what I knew had to be a messy and inherently degrading act. How else could she now be walking around dressed conservatively in a neatly ironed blouse with flowered barrettes and her perfectly combed hair while letting the world see that she was with child? How could she say hello to the older cashier who smiled sweetly and asked when she was due if she wasn't ashamed of the fact that her round belly was informing all who saw her that she engaged in sexual intercourse? How could she head into the crowded parking lot and show her fellow shoppers that she had given in to what I knew had to be the basest of animalistic instincts unless she and everyone around her knew that she had done it in the most innocent way possible? And how could I even begin to grapple with the idea that everyone I'd ever met in my life who had children, my parents, my friends' parents, the people at church, my teachers, the den mothers in my Cub Scout chapter, even our school's playground ladies, had at one time or another had sex, and that more likely they had all had sex on a regular basis?
That's Paul Feig reading from his new memoir, Superstud, or How I Became a 24-Year-Old Virgin. Paul, you say that, you know, your brain and your religion told you that sex was a terrible thing. What did your religion have to say about it?
Well, I was brought up as a Christian Scientist, and which in its essence, I guess, is kind of a new age religion, an old new age religion that I don't practice anymore. But one of the main kind of tenets behind it is that you're not supposed to give any power to the physical realm, and that in that way, then you can sort of heal yourself or overcome disease by not dwelling in the physical, you know, the physical body. And so because of that, clearly, you know, sex is one of those things that you're not supposed to let rule your world. When I was in Sunday school, I remember there was a pamphlet on a table that I saw every Sunday for my entire childhood that said chastity, the premarital standard. And so it was like, okay, well, so we're not really supposed to sex. We're not supposed to think about it because that's giving into it. And all that really wrapped up into, A, excusing me from having to kind of mature sexually and to grapple with it, and B, to be a total geek when it came to thinking about it.
Now, you say your brain also told you sex was a terrible thing. What was your brain telling you?
My brain was working from a large dose of fear, I think, because, you know, I was terrified of, when I was in gym class, having to get undressed in front of other guys, you know, and just into my underwear to put on my gym shorts, although then the whole showering thing came in later was absolutely terrifying. But I was just completely afraid of exposing myself that way to anybody, just physically. And so then the idea of thinking that then you were going to make the leap to not only disrobing, but then interacting with another person's body in the most intimate way possible, short of surgery, and so kind of what I just could not get my head around it. And so between my fearful brain and my religious voice inside my head, it was not a recipe for catting around, as they might say.
Well, you were warned, and you felt that you know, sexual relations before marriage was a very bad thing. You were also warned about masturbation and about all the evils of that. And you even heard on the radio that you'd lose a day of your life for each time that you did it. So, which didn't stop you, but what did it do in terms of making you feel bad about it or guilty about yourself?
Well, that's the part that gets me crazy, because my misinterpretation, a lot of it was my own personal misinterpretation of the way that I chose to see the rules of my religion and then the rules of morality from the outside. Like you say, when I was in Jamaica with my parents when I was a kid on a vacation, we heard this DJ say that you lost a day off your life for every time you masturbated. That went into my brain like the main tenet of my youth, basically. And so it was horrifying, but the drive and the urge was so strong, I literally started kind of doing this bartering with myself. I'm like, okay, well, all right, I'm supposed to live till I'm 90. So, okay, so I can probably lose the last 5 years of my life because I'll probably be senile. And so it's sort of like this kind of altruistic, preemptive euthanasia I was going to do on myself. You know, but then suddenly you start to go like, wait a minute, what if I'm only supposed to live till I'm 25? And, okay, I've already lopped off 6 years. And, oh, my God, the next time could be the one and I'm just going to drop dead. And so this was something that really followed me, not just through my childhood, but like anything you learn as a kid, it gets ingrained in your head, and if it's an unprovable rule, I can't personally prove that you don't lose a day of your life every time you masturbate. Maybe you do. I don't know. It went into my head, and I could not get it out of my – it just became programmed in me. I mean, I'm talking about through college. You know, even when I was like, oh, that's ridiculous, and I kind of tossed it off, it's just something that – those rules that you learn as a kid, they creep in the back of your head. This is wrong, and also there's going to be a real consequence for you doing this.
To fully appreciate your story, I think one would need to see the cover of your memoir, Superstud, which has you have these wonderful pictures of your life. Your first memoir had a great picture. This one is a terrific follow-up. It's you in a white, like post-John Travolta Saturday Night Fever suit with a large green, like pale green bow tie, the size of those like tuxedo bow ties, those supersized ones. Actually, this probably is a white tuxedo now that I look more closely.
No, this was my, as you say, Saturday Night Fever / Steve Martin suit. It served two roles. I could both boogie down in this and also recite all of Steve Martin's first album to it. This picture is from, I was in dance class for most of my childhood. I took tap dancing. At first I took ballet at the local YMCA when I was very small. And then once that secret got out into the school, I promptly stopped doing that. But then decided I wanted to be Gene Kelly. And asked my mother to take me to a tap dancing class, and I got enrolled in this tap dancing class, and I was in it for 6 years. I was the only boy in the class, and in the entire 6 years I was in the class, I never said one word to the other girls in the class, and they never said one word to me. I was kind of this 600-pound geeky elephant in the middle of the room. And in all the 6 years, I never learned a time step. It was the biggest ripoff ever. They never taught me how to tap dance. They taught me how to do jazz with tap shoes on. And any dancers out there, all I learned how to do was flap, ball, change. So the cover of this book is actually from one of my dance recitals. I took my Steve Martin / John Travolta suit, and they gave me a spicy green tuxedo shirt with ruffles and the big tie. And if you look closer, you can see the taps on my shoes.
Oh, my gosh, there they are.
See? lest you not believe me.
Well, I'm encouraged to hear that this was actually a costume. I thought this was a prom picture.
No. Me and my imaginary date. Well, the sad thing is I wish I could say it was a costume, but then I did proudly wear this outfit around quite a bit. Sans the tap shoes, because I was also into roller skating, and so I would wear my recital outfits to roller skate on Saturday mornings. And I don't know why girls wouldn't skate with me. It's hard to say. With tassels.
What was it like to be like the straight boy in ballet and tap class?
It was. I didn't have any kind of take on it because I wasn't in sports. I did one terrible summer in Little League, but that was kind of in the middle of it all. So to me, it was just kind of this. What's possibly wrong with this? I want to learn how to dance. There's everyone in my class is a girl, but. It didn't seem like an unnatural thing to me until people found out, and then suddenly I started getting beaten up every day for it. And then you go, oh, I see. I guess I'm not supposed to let people know. But I still couldn't get it through my head because I go, look at Gene Kelly dances, and look how cool he is, and Donald O'Connor dances, and he's hilarious, and Fred Astaire is really cool and suave. And then you had the Nicholas brothers who were these just physical, amazing dancers who could do all these things. And I was like, well, how could people not think that's the coolest thing in the world? And quickly found out, apparently, they did not think it was the coolest thing in the world.
My guest is Paul Feig. His new memoir is called Superstud. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Hey.
My guest is Paul Feig. He created the TV series Freaks and Geeks and directed episodes of Undeclared. His new memoir is called Superstud, or How I Became a 24-Year-Old Virgin.
Because you're most famous for Freaks and Geeks and for your memoirs about being a nerdy kid, it's kind of a surprise that the movie that you did last year really has nothing to do with that kind of life at all. The movie was called I Am David, and it's based on a novel about a Bulgarian boy who escapes a Stalinist labor camp in the early 50s. So I'm wondering why you gravitated to that subject.
It's funny. It at first glance, it does seem like a complete departure, and yet I always have felt like an outsider, like I think most of us in life do feel. And all the stories I tend to gravitate towards, be it Freaks and Geeks or I Am David, are about outsiders. And to me, I Am David is about this kid who has grown up in this communist labor camp and nobody knows who he is. And then he has to escape and kind of work his way through, get across Europe to try to find his home. And nobody knows him. To me, it was almost like the ultimate outsider story. A friend of mine always makes fun of it, though. He says, basically, all you did is turn high school into the worst communist labor camp you could find. It's like, I guess in a way you're right.
Jim Caviezel was in I Am David, and after making your movie, he made Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. What was it like seeing him as Christ and seeing all the controversy around his portrayal of Christ?
It was weird. I mean, when he first showed up on the set, he pulled me aside and he said, hey, I got to tell you a secret. I'm going to be playing Jesus Christ in this Mel Gibson movie. I was like, wow, really? And he said, yeah. He said, when Mel told me, he basically pulled me in and said, hey, Jim, you ready to ruin your career? And I was like, oh, God, and you're about to do my movie. But, you know, it turned out to be a wonderful thing for him. It was odd. I mean, Jim's a great guy. I mean, he's such a – he was so much fun to work with because he's got such a great attitude towards what he does. But then it's very weird to see that come out, especially after, you know, the frustration of having finished our movie way before that, and since our distribution was all a mess, we didn't come out till after it. So that feeling of like people are going to go, oh, well, clearly Feig tries to cash in on the Jesus thing, which Lionsgate, who put the movie out, didn't help with, because the poster is Jim Caviezel's face. It's tall as a building. And then the little kid who's actually the star of the movie is kind of looking out from behind Jim's face, which I know Jim was really upset about that poster, and as was I. But the weird thing was that actually five actors from my movie ended up in Passion of the Christ, because I had the same Italian casting director that Mel Gibson had.
Oh.
And so we found all these kind of great people, and then when he went to do the movie, she was like, oh, hey, we have all these great people we just found, including the guy that played Pontius Pilate was a guy we found in Bulgaria. He was a Bulgarian actor that we found who'd been doing these kind of crummy, you know, cable movies. And, you know, all of a sudden he's a big shot. So my movie came out and all these reviews are like, oh, well, you know, Feig raids Mel Gibson's cast. It's like, he took my cast.
That's funny. So what are you working on now?
I'm going to be directing a movie called Stargirl, which is this movie I'm going to do for Nickelodeon and Paramount, which it's another book that I adapted. And it's just a fantastic story. It's a fairly popular young adult book from like 2000, the year 2000, about it's high school again. I don't know why I keep ending up in high school. It's just, for me, something about the high school and teenage years are so great, because it's, people are still out of their minds at that point, and it's still okay to be completely over-emotional and crazy and overreacting to everything. And I just find that funny. When I write that way, you know, about somebody in their 20s or 30s, people go, yeah, why can't that guy get it together? What's wrong with him?
What were the movies or TV shows about high school that made the biggest impression on you when you were in high school?
Ironically, I didn't like any of the ones. I mean, I know people like Square Pegs. I never really watched that. It was more for me that I rebelled all the time against all the entertainment, because it was always either too sugary sweet, like, you know, I loved the Brady Bunch, but at the same time, I realized that wasn't real life. Or it was, you know, these kind of cheerleader movies that were always out, that, you know, when my friends and I would go to the drive-in, there would always be previews for these kind of tough cheerleader movies, and it made high school look like this, you know, rumble, and girls were having sex with guys all the time. So, because there weren't, as far as I remember, other than like the White Shadow, which I really liked, but that was like an inner city school, so I'm in the suburbs, so I couldn't quite relate to that. I didn't have any take on it. The shows that more influenced me, I hate to say, were things like Leave It to Beaver and old films like The Little Rascals. Because what I liked about those, even though Leave It to Beaver is very corny and sort of that Brady Bunch way, the way that the kids act in those old things, they act like kids. They don't talk like adults. And that's always been my problem with anything that stars kids. It's just all these guys in their 30s and 40s writing lines for kids that a 30 and 40-year-old guy would say that a kid would never say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's always kind of my goal, is to try to get real performances out of kids, because you know, it's all that older guys trying to right the wrongs of, you know, when I was a kid I got beat up, so now I'm gonna have this kid be he's wisecracking and he really sticks it to those bullies with some erudite joke. Right, exactly. And on the show, it's always like the bully's like, hey, how dare you, and runs away. And in real life, you know, you just get socked and beat up even worse if you one-upped him.
Well, Paul Feig, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, Terry, thanks so much. It's a real pleasure.
Paul Feig, his new memoir is called Super Stud. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Universal South, presenting Pages, a new album from the Russian band Bering Strait, available at participating stores, beringstraitonline.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Kevin Bacon. His film The Woodsman is now out on DVD. Bacon's other movies include Footloose, Diner, Apollo 13, Murder in the First, The River Wild, and Mystic River. Join us for the next Fresh Air.